Mini episode 861 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to FDH Lounge mini episode number 861. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here with one of our favorite recurring guests, Colin Delaney, proprietor of ePolitics.com, on to talk about the six-month mark here with the Trump administration, which we were laughing about off-air. It seems simultaneously longer and shorter than that at the same time here that we have gone through this. And one of the things that I have to say, Colin, that whenever I'm trying to catch up on what's going on with ePolitics and I go to do a Google thing on your name, consistently here, I will get the suggestion from Google. Do you mean Colin Delaney with an E, the one-legged wrestler who used to be with WWE.com? I look forward to once you have surpassed him far on the scale and left that guy in the rearview mirror to where I never get that on my search queries again, Colin.
Well, I'll tell you what, man. You know, he was a tag team with Tommy Dreamer for a long time. I mean, how can I beat that?
Tommy Dreamer, man, one of my all-time favorites. You got on my good side right off the bat by mentioning that. I am a guy who has had since 2001 a fantasy baseball team called the Innovators of Violence, so that tells you all you need to know.
It's great to be with you, Rick, always.
Well, thank you. I've been looking forward to this. We did a breakdown. I'm sort of afraid of what might happen while we're recording this because what happened a while back here, whenever it was that good old James Comey got whacked, I was right in the middle of recording a Trump analysis segment with another friend of the show, our good friend Alice Hennigan, and we managed to get through the entire thing here without mentioning that because neither one of us had seen that it happened. And then it gets done, and I was like, son of a bitch, everything we said is going to look dated, you know? So here's hoping that Trump can keep whatever impulses under control until such time as we get this posted.
Well, it's an occupational hazard these days, right? I mean, I'll shut down at like 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, go for a walk, go meet some friends for a beer. You think everything's fine in the world. You come back and we're about to nuke somebody.
Could be. Could very well be. And again, that's one of many situations that we want to get to. And since that's one I think that we'll probably talk about more so in passing just because nobody really knows what's going to happen, I guess we could do that now. It's funny because I was doing a segment about a week or so ago with a gentleman that does a sports business radio show, and I said to him, we were talking about a lot of different sports business topics, predominantly the NBA, because that's what's in the headlines these days. But I said, you know, nobody's really talking about it, but this is a thing where the Winter Olympics next year, I'm not so sure they're going to happen. You know, I just like what happens, you know, I mean, if something broke out tomorrow, there would be no Winter Olympics. You couldn't get everything cleared away. The carnage is going to be too bad. And again, the human toll is what's most important here. But just the fact that we could be talking about something like this with the volatile kind of situation over there, that is going to be one of the IOC head scratchers of all time if something tragic does happen between now and then.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of people in Seoul who are within artillery range of the North.
Yep.
Let's just leave it at that. So
there are.
There's a reason that people have been long before nuclear weapons. There's a reason that, or long before the North had nuclear weapons, that people have been very cautious in dealing with them.
Well, and I go to this thing, I said this a long time ago, sometime post-Cold War, Pat Buchanan wrote a column, and I unsurprisingly liked it. This was a column about, you know, the thing about why do we still have troops in South Korea? And I understand the whole thing. You want to deter aggression, whatever, but that's a Cold War relic. And when I read that column, as I've read a lot of his things, when he was talking about why do we still have all the bases in Europe, why do we still have all of this? I mean, if somebody could make a case for me on that stuff, fine. But it's a thing where, I mean, now we're trapped, Colin. You can't pull them out in the midst of this kind of crisis here. This was not the hour to do this. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, if we would have looked at it and like, why do we still have them over there? It's too late to get that question answered in a satisfactory manner.
Well, the thing is that we have troops there. We have troops in Japan.
Yep.
We have troops in Europe.
Yep.
For our purposes, it gives us power. It gives us leverage. And let's face it, the last 70 years is the longest time in European history that they've gone without a war.
Right.
Between major powers of any kind. And I suspect that the presence of those troops and the work done by the Marshall Plan after the war and all the other Marshall, was a chief of staff of the U.S. Army. He certainly understood, power in the world. And we have those troops there because, generations of leaders have decided that the influence it gives us on the world is important enough to keep them.
Now,
we can disagree about that. But there's no mystery why they're there. They're there to project U.S. power.
Here I mark myself as a paleocon for the first of many times in this conversation. So you're talking about American hegemony. Good to know. All right. So we've got that part established.
Yeah, and absolutely, sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the whole thing, the world policeman thing. Yes, it brings a lot of problems with it. But America has benefited more from that than anyone else. America has benefited more from the post-war trade regime than any other country by far.
We have, but I'll tell you, this is one of these things where, again, if something unfortunate happens and we appear to be creeping closer and closer to that by the day, I mean, I'm going to feel awful for all of the loss of human life over there. But, being the nationalist that I am, I would say top of the pyramid for me is going to be all of our sons and daughters who are going to be, I won't say sitting ducks, because I got to believe that we have some pretty good bunkers and everything like that. I got to believe that we have taken time over the years to try to do what we can to keep them out of that. But we're going to lose a buttload of them, man. We are. And it just, that's one of those things where, that's going to be one of the questions, I think, in the aftermath is remind me again why we were still over there. And you make some interesting points, but those are points that I'm afraid are not going to seem so salient once we start losing human life, which hopefully we won't.
Yeah, one would hope. I mean, the modern age, what you do is disperse.
Yeah.
Anything that can be seen can be hit.
Yep.
So, regardless, let's just put it this way. We've been in a state of armistice with North Korea for, 65 years?
Yep.
That's a lot of presidents who have managed not to go to war.
True.
With North Korea. Going to war with North Korea is optional.
It is.
It's only going to happen if someone chooses to make it happen.
Yeah, but there's an inevitability thing that basically turns out to happen. If you look back on it here, if you look at, and I would say both Gulf Wars, essentially, and the first one, I think, a lot more understandable. We put the troops in Saudi Arabia because it looked like they might be next. But with the Gulf War, the second time around, the Iraq War, it becomes a thing where once things have gone past a certain point, that's where it really becomes impossible to back down, both on a geopolitical scale and then also with the president that we have right now, who is loudly proclaiming that the era of strategic patience is over, whatever that means. So there comes a point in time, unfortunately, when things become inevitable.
Well, again, I don't think anything's inevitable on this earth except gravity and taxes, and I assume that, although I'm trying to fight that one off as long as I can.
Me too.
But, with the Gulf War, you want to go back to the 2003 war, one of the things that was amazing was the extent to which the broadcast news media, particularly, like, if you were reading the newspapers or, a lot of online stuff, it was different. But the broadcast news media in particular seemed to be hungry for a war.
Yep.
It takes you back to Hearst and the Spanish-American War, right? They want to cover it, where there were a lot of people who were saying things that turned out to be accurate.
Yep.
But there are other critics who could not get airtime on cable news. Could not. And I don't think, you know, if it feels inevitable, it's because we're choosing to let it be inevitable.
That's a good point. Yeah. Well, you know, as far as it goes with that, though, it's a thing where, unfortunately, I think there was a lot of steam that was still in the kettle here after 9/11, because we did not realize at the time, Afghanistan, that we had won merely the first phase of the war in Afghanistan. It felt like we won the war in Afghanistan in about 6 weeks. And it was really a thing where I don't think it's I won't go to the bottom line, you know, thing of here that we hadn't released enough aggression yet. But as far as the magnitude of what had happened to this country, you know, as far as the catharsis there, I don't think you can underestimate that part of it and why people were susceptible to it, because we needed a catharsis and it ended up being the exact opposite of that in the long run.
Well, and I'll tell you, you know, whether or not we need his catharsis, there were a whole lot of people, Dick Cheney,
yeah,
who were very happy to manipulate truth,
yes,
in order to get it into that war.
Yes.
They manipulated the media. They manipulated people like Colin Powell. They lied. They lied us into a war. And, you know, you talk about we thought Afghanistan was won. Nobody that I read who knew anything about Afghanistan thought that, right? Mm-hmm. Afghanistan's been the graveyard of empires.
Right.
Go back to the British expeditions. Go back to the Russians.
Right.
Anyone who thought this was easy and over was either ignorant of history or, willfully ignorant of history. Anyway, there's a lot more we can talk about.
There is. Well, I'll tell you what, since we're on geopolitics, let's use the inevitable segue to the domestic sphere here, this being Russia, and this is a thing here where I got to tell you, and again, just to reestablish for anybody who has not caught any of the past shows here between us, first of all, you need to go catch up on those ones, for anybody that hasn't really with the dynamic, I think it's fair to say that when you look at it, if you look at the Obama administration, the Trump administration, Obama, as you had made clear on a bunch of different times, I wouldn't really say necessarily was your guy, but he at the very least might get done a lot of things that you might like to see done. To a slightly lesser extent, that's what I would call Trump for me. Maybe in spite of his own instincts, he's going to sign some things into law that I might like. He got a guy on the Supreme Court that I like. You know, basically, yeah. So I'm not a Trump guy. I'd say I'm less of a Trump guy than you were an Obama guy. And you know, I think it would be simplistic to have called you an Obama guy. So, you know, you and I
would call myself an Obama guy.
Oh, okay.
I disagreed with him on plenty of things.
Okay.
But, I supported him early.
Okay, well, and see, here's what's interesting, is that, and I go back to his first term, which that shows you how long we've been doing this. We've been doing this since at least 2010, and you were you were impatient with him on a lot of stuff there, and it's funny, because I'll bet you, now that it's all said and done, I'll bet you agree with my perspective a little more. I said, yes, he is a guy from your side of the aisle who's more of an incrementalist than you like, but he is getting as much done as he thinks that he can under the circumstances here. And I think you even conceded at some point in the second term that, especially culturally, I mean, he was all you could have wanted and then some. Culturally, you know, I would say a pretty radical president. If you look at the history, if you look at the arc of this country and the way that things changed while he was in office, which I would say he had a lot to do with. And I don't, from my perspective as a religious traditionalist, I don't say that in a complimentary way, but I say that in a give the devil his due day. He was very impactful, particularly culturally. He spoke of when he came in wanting to be sort of the Reagan of his side. Culturally, I think it's undeniable that he was. Whether he got as much stuff done as you would have liked economically, healthcare-wise, etc., you know, again, he was, I remember in his first term, he was more of an incrementalist than you liked. Maybe you kind of came around to that in the end. Maybe you didn't.
I'm going to disagree. I worked in the Texas legislature.
Okay. Sure.
I know all about the legislative grind. I was actually defending him at the time against a lot of my, you know, more idealistic liberal friends. I still have friends say, oh, Obama got nothing done. And you're like, really? You know, the guy who got more, you know, major legislation passed than anybody since LBJ got nothing done, right? But what it is is you got nothing done compared to their idealized version from watching too much of the West Wing of what things ought to be. As far as the cultural changes that happened under Obama, it's a really good question. You know, the acceptance of gay people isn't just happening in America. You know, marriage passed in Spain, you know, and often, you know, a conservative Catholic country through most of history, passed in Spain before it passed here.
Well,
you know?
That's interesting.
They're just in the air. You know, we are becoming a more inclusive world.
Well, and it's a thing where, and you and I have agreed on this on the show previously, that again, when he ran for president the first time, and he was like, oh, that thing I filled out when I ran for the state legislature in Illinois, of course I don't believe in gay marriage. You and I cried BS on that. He never stopped being in favor of it, but it's a thing where, again, you know, couldn't really mouth it for most of the first term, but through the second term, if you look at it, if you look at the pace of, you know, change in America, that administration had as much to do with it as anything, I would say, by the time they fully got on board. And it's a thing where I don't expect you to agree with what I'm about to assert here, but when I see the Democrats not being able to push it over the hump in some of these special elections, Montana, Georgia, whatever. And yeah, Nancy Pelosi's been shorthand for this, but San Fran Nan, as she has often been called, when you're looking at, you know, the shorthand for Democratic Party, what is sold in rural country and what I would classify as cultural radicalism, that one of the things you're looking at here, I think there was a lot of spiking the ball in Obama's second term. And one of the things I think that hurt Hillary in some of the rural areas in the Midwest states that she lost here, this whole, you know, presumption that, of course, the rest of the country's with us on this stuff and the bathroom bill, you know, for as much as guys on your side want to say that, you know, the whole thing about the bathroom bill, whatever. There is a thing here. There is a wide discomfort out there with the notion that a grown man can get out there, show his genitals in a woman's room in front of a 7-year-old girl. These are things that are not made up out of whole cloth as far as what the law could possibly allow under the circumstances here. So, I mean, as far as...
Excuse me, one second.
Sure.
Just one second. Can you point to one instance anywhere?
Not an instance of it happening, but I'm talking about the law's amended.
A lot of instances of trans people who've had the shit beaten out of them.
Sure.
Because they had to use the men's room when they identified as a woman.
Sure.
That's a real problem, not a hypothetical
right.
problem. And as far as the voting on this goes,
mm-hmm.
you'll note that in North Carolina, the Democrats beat the Republican who was in favor of SB2, in favor of the bathroom law. It is not the Democrats making the bathrooms a big deal. It is the Republicans trying to push anti-trans legislation.
By the
way, they're the ones making it a cultural thing.
Let me say for the record that I said, and I believe on the show, in the first place, it was a bad idea for the Republicans to have put it through because I called it. I said, they're going to fold in the end. They're going to fold. They're going to repeal this, and more damage will be done to the cause of traditionalists by folding than by having something in there, because we saw it play out in Indiana. Mike Pence, who is allegedly this radical right guy on cultural issues, folded like a deck of cards when big business came. Big business, which, by the way, so many people still think for whatever reason is inherently conservative, and which is crap. I mean, if Indiana, we should have squashed that long before Indiana, but when the whole bake me a cake movement in Indiana pretty much got pushed through by big business, I said in advance that North Carolina, they were playing their cards in a bad way. They're going to fold, and it's going to go down as being a bad thing. But it's one of these things where, again, there's that taint out there. And, you know, what you're saying about that, listen, I think it's a thing where I think the North Carolina bill, if I remember correctly, it was basically like what you were born as or whatever. Really, it ought to just be, you know, whatever genitals you got right now. Nobody's going to know the difference, basically, you know, whether you were born with them or not. So that's one of those things.
Are you checking? Who's checking at the bathroom door to see what genitals a short-haired, slender, blonde person dressed in non-gender distinctive clothing wears?
Exactly.
Who's checking?
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to enforce any of this stuff?
Well, exactly.
What you have had, though, is people run screaming that there is a man in the women's room, and it turns out to be a mannish-looking woman.
Yeah.
There have been a number of cases of that kind of thing. Why can't we, like the good conservatives, stay out of other people's business? Why legislate anything like that? Stay out of people's business. That's the conservative thing to do. Live free or die.
Well, you know, there's liberty, and then there's the libertine kind of perspective here, and that's where I think we kind of cross over. And again, I think there was legitimate.
So you want to tell somebody else how to live their life?
No, right. I'm not, and that's a thing where I think again, for anybody that's the one thing that I think should be broadly sort of non-controversial about this is that anybody that is dealing with, any kind of trans issues or anything like that, again, I come from, the religious traditionalist perspective, whatever, but again, being a religiously oriented person, part of that that's baked in the cake, I think, is, certainly compassion for an individual.
Yeah.
Nobody that's dealing with any of that kind of stuff has an easy kind of a life, so if we can do it in a way where we're trying to set safe boundaries here, not do it in a way where there's demonization, but again, I think the way that the bathroom bill is gone, and I go back to how it was in Houston previously, too, the way that I've seen possible interpretations of the law is allowing for basically flashing type scenarios that would be broadly illegal everywhere pretty much right now.
Yeah,
and we can.
And they still would be.
Well,
they still would be. Like I said, the opponents, unfortunately, they tend to deal in these very emotionally charged, someone's going to flash my kid. That is illegal. I could go running around flashing my junk in the men's room. If I did, they'd call the cops.
Colin, it's impossible to say this without being graphic, but the entire point of being in the men's room is to take your genitals out and whiz in front of, in most cases, open urinal. That's what you do. You take your genitals out in the bathroom.
Yes.
So I think that's where we're coming into this here. If you're a man taking your genitals out in the women's room.
No, they don't have urinals in a women's room.
I understand that. And one would hope that everyone is just going into the stall, closing the door. You know what I mean?
I come back to this idea that in the minds of a lot of people, trans and pervert mean the same thing. They are different things. Trans people are not perverts who are running around flashing people. Trans people, their minds and their bodies don't mesh. They have a different mind than their body is wired for. Our biology is very complicated. People who are sex offenders flash people. Like the kid who lived across from me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I flashed, some of my sister's friends, right?
Yeah.
Those aren't trans people. And if they masquerade as trans people, they're going to get busted and go to jail.
That's what we're talking about.
People.
That's what we're talking about, is people taking advantage.
Right.
That's what we're talking about.
But again, no one has ever pointed to a single episode that I've ever heard of this happening. And instead, so we focus on this thing that doesn't happen, instead of focusing on the thing that does happen, which is trans people getting beaten up because they're, someone who looks like a woman is forced to use the men's room. I don't know if you went to high school, but, my God, anybody who was a little bit different risked getting the hell beat out of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, that has continued to be a thing up until very recently, and in some quarters probably still the case today. I guess I would beg to differ on media coverage of gay bashing. I'll co-sign on you didn't see as much of it 10, 15 years ago, whatever. There's a healthy amount of it out there today. I mean, if you want to get historical on it, I think you're 100% correct. But I think today, if you look around, there's a decent amount of coverage of it.
There is, and I find that heartening, because there was virtual none for most of our history.
And again,
it's been a transformation. And listen, I remember vividly that when I had recently moved to D.C., which is a very gay-friendly city, the first time I ever saw two guys make out in public, it freaked me out, and that was just 20 years ago. Everything changes. Now I wouldn't even notice.
Well, I mean, that's a That's a societal.
I have you know, a ridiculous number of friends who are now in same-sex married couples.
Well,
it is no longer even noteworthy.
It is no longer even noteworthy. I'll co-sign on that 100%. And let's just, for the listeners out there, let's leave that as a Rorschach test as to what you think about that. You have your thoughts. I have my thoughts. That's the ink blot. Yeah, that's the ink blot that everybody can stare about. Well, if you
why
think...
Why does it matter what you think about what someone else does? If you're a good conservative, then, you know, a liberty-minded person, policing someone else's private behavior, who they love.
I'm not in favor of that.
Cross your mind.
I'm not in favor of policing private behavior. I am not in favor of that. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you here at this point in time. Obama can take a lot of credit for what I'm about to say right now. He can take a lot of personal credit for how he helped move the ball. But this is a thing where, you know, I think in the 10 years of doing the show here, I think that in order to avoid anything that would be damaging to the show or to this property or anything like that, I've had to sort of speak more just generically. I am a religious conservative, lifelong Roman Catholic, whatever, and just kind of leave it at that, and that where people know where I'm coming from on that kind of stuff. Because, again, the climate is such that, you know, I'm kind of fighting with one arm tied behind my back here, because the presumption in society these days is that you're a bigot, you're this, you're that, you're whatever. So that's why I really don't delve further into it other than the generic overall kind of a thing, because I have no intention of bringing any kind of damage upon myself or upon the program by doing that. And that if you are out there, again, there's nothing that I, and not to sound defeatist, but there's nothing I can say to change the arc of society here. So I'm not going to expend a lot of energy and effort on doing that.
Sure. Let me just lay this on you.
Yeah.
I think if you treat every human being with respect, you don't have a whole lot to worry about.
Yeah. And that's, again, you know.
I mean, a lot of people right now screaming politically correct this, politically correct that. And believe me, I am the last person who's going to want to infringe on anyone's speech, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think people like the people on the college campuses who are shutting down conservative speakers, I think that is stupid, short-sighted, and counterproductive. But there are a lot of things that people are like, oh, you can't say that because it's not politically correct. What they're really saying is, I cannot disrespect someone the way I used to be able to.
As long as
you treat everybody with respect, I think you're in pretty good shape.
Well, again, you know, for the handful of people who I have known in my life who are gay, and it's, I'm going to say it's a handful relative to you, you know, I'd be shocked if any of them had any kind of sense of having been treated poorly by me, because that's sort of my default thing, is that I don't really do that to people. But it's a thing where I absolutely, you know, I do feel inhibited, as opposed to, again, you know, why I think the traditionalist view for society is a healthy thing for society. And again, I think that's an inherently respectful and respectable take to have, but I certainly feel inhibited from making it and from going further into. If you kind of identify what your perspective is, people know where you're at. People know what your take is going to be on gay marriage, on you know, unisex bathrooms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of why I don't go further into it than that, because I think, again, you know, the ball has moved in society. Obama could take a lot of credit for that. Things are a lot different at the end of his 8 years than they were the beginning of it. Somehow or another, before this, we were starting to get to Russia here, which is an interesting thing. Before we got on the cultural, that's quite a cul-de-sac we went down here. For anybody that watched season 3 of Fargo, that was somewhat akin to episode 3 of season 3 of Fargo here. This was the Los Angeles trip, essentially, in a nutshell. Of course, I've got that on my mind, having just done our season 3 review of it. But as far as it goes with Russia here, this is a thing where, again, I'm going to have a little bit of fun with you on this one here, because, again, I'm old enough to remember the Cold War, all right? So it's a thing where, again, it's awfully nice to see Democrats worked up about Russia these days. I mean, it's 30 or 40 years later than I would have liked to have seen it, I think, when it would have counted. But, you know, it's a thing where you got that going on. This whole thing about interference.
The Cold War?
Well, you had, listen, you had Ted Kennedy going
up.
You had Ted.
Harry Truman?
No, well,
Marshall?
Post-1968. Post-1968,
okay.
you had Ted Kennedy going to Moscow in 83 going, hey, is there any way we can collude to keep Reagan from winning re-election here? Any kind of fake peace gestures you can throw us?
Well,
you know,
I don't know about that one. I'll have to look that one
I think that
I
was in
know.
That was in the Soviet archives. John Kerry, who couldn't stop hugging Sandinistas back in the day, John Kerry all of a sudden is worked up about, OMG, Russians wanting to take over the world. You look at Time magazine in the 90s. They were crowing about this. Hey, isn't it great? We're working with Yeltsin to make sure he wins re-election over there. Now, that was in our national interest that Yeltsin win that.
Hang on. Which Democratic politician is Time magazine? Right?
No. I was making somewhat of a separate point there.
I am as strong as any communist as you're going to get. And you know, funding the Nicaraguan... we were funding murderers.
Well, to me, that's an acid test. If you weren't pro-Contra, I don't know how anti-communist you could have been. And keep in mind, I mean, I was on the campuses in those days at the tail end of the Cold War. I don't know how... That's an acid test to me, and it always will be. So
really?
I will,
are you serious?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
I have a friend. I have a friend here in D.C. Who is a Nicaraguan guy.
Yeah.
And he was... basically, his father was in the military. He was a mascot
okay.
of Death Squad. They would use him as bait. They would have him walk down the street and just start talking to somebody and distract people while they went in the back door and murdered people inside. The other side was equally horrible.
You could be
loathe everything about communism. And still think that the Contras were horrible human beings that we had no business funding.
Well, I'm going to say, look, there were definitely elements of the Somoza regime that were in there. I'm not going to deny that. There were also, I don't know if you'll admit this, there were also people who started off being with the Sandinistas who grew disillusioned with them being Ruski puppets who went off to the other side here. So I'm going to say it was a mix of the two.
I'm not saying that I supported the other side.
Okay. Well, John Kerry did.
Well, I'm just
the leading Democratic politicians did is what I'm saying. And in the 80s, if you were a Democratic politician, it was cool to downplay the whole, oh, there's no Soviet threat. Grr. Meanwhile, now, 30 years later,
Charlie Wilson, Democratic congressman.
A great congressman. And Colin, you know he's a total outlier. A great congressman. But
I would say that the outlier are the far lefties that you like to point to as being representative of the mainstream Democratic Party.
The mainstream Democratic Party was opposed to what Reagan was doing to fight them in the 80s. They were opposed to the military buildup.
Your average Democratic Congress member back in the 80s was probably a Southerner.
Well,
right?
Tip O'Neill was the speaker. How in favor was Tip O'Neill of the military buildup? I mean, he traded it off for Reagan giving him basically a blank check on domestic spending, but he wasn't in favor of it.
I never spoke to the man about it.
Oh, we're going to this now. Okay, I never talked to him.
No,
so.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know that Tip O'Neill said that. I know that Tip O'Neill, his House of Representatives, that he did a pretty good job of running. Passed the funding for the military buildup.
Yeah, because Reagan right. made a coalition with the boll weevils that you mentioned in the South.
Okay. So again,
Reagan plucked off the outliers. He had a majority with the Republicans and the boll weevils.
You're picking and choosing who gets to be an outlier here. The Democratic Party is a party that it is a giant coalition. It is a lot of different groups in society. In the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of very left members, more than there are now, but there were also a lot of people from the former Confederacy who were not
sure.
particularly liberal in a lot of ways.
Sure.
So I just think it doesn't make sense. It actually hurts your argument to treat them worked.
But both parties have gotten to be more pure in the last 30 years. Those ones plucked off, they by and large became Republicans, the ones that were opposed to communism, or they retired, or both. And it's a thing where, and interesting...
Or if I may be blunt, opposed to black people.
In some cases,
strong
yeah.
Strom Thurmond is a great example. Jesse Helm. I waited tables on Jesse Helm one time when I was living in North Carolina. I'll tell you about him another day. I worked in the Texas legislature when the conservative Democrats were going away. When particular minority leaders of the state screwed up and got disgraced, the amount of glee that these old white guys showed was just disgusting.
Well,
I mean, I am not kidding you. And those people are gone now. Their districts are represented by Republicans.
Well, look, in terms of public statements, Strom Thurmond may have been a member of Congress and the Senate who didn't have a very good record on race, but Strom's member itself had a pretty good record on race, if you're picking up what I'm putting down. So, you know, I don't know if that offsets it at all. But
No, it doesn't. We're talking Thomas Jefferson and Alabama. That was the classic thing for upper-class white people in the South. To, shall we say, take advantage of the power differential.
He certainly did do that, but that's a thing where, and I made the case about Time Magazine prematurely here, because interestingly enough, we're this far into it and really haven't gotten much into Trump yet, which is, goes to show you about, there's an existing landscape that he came onto. We tend to think of him as the alpha and the omega of making things complicated. He's making things more complicated in the public these days, but you and I are laying down the groundwork of what was already out there. In the 90s, this thing with Yeltsin, Time Magazine was playing it up. We were openly supporting Yeltsin. We were openly over there trying to use every mechanism to keep him installed in power, as we've done in many other countries. And it's a thing where I don't like Yeltsin. I don't know too many people that do, but it's a thing where he's acting in his national interest. So it's a thing where it's okay for us to do stuff, and we're just looking out for ourselves. But the minute that Yeltsin does it, again, there's a broad rubric here. The one thing Trump is right about is everything is getting lumped together here as far as, the Russians were out there. No doubt they were doing some things here and there in terms of mischief or whatever, but this broad sort of presumption that the Trump people were tied into it and everything like that, we're looking at something here where Russia was, again, acting in the national interest as, held up by one dictator who is not a good guy, but nevertheless acting in that perceived national interest here. And this story to this point in time has gotten conflated into the Trump people were necessarily involved in that. Again, I think Trump is one of the many things that he's been a moron on. When he fired Comey, I mean, I knew that was going to be trouble. I mean, I maintain that Trump has a talent for making himself look more guilty than he is, just out of arrogance or whatever. And we'll see if I'm right or wrong about that. It may be that he's as guilty as the whole world thinks that he is. But, to me, the straightest point between two lines here is just that Trump thinks he can do whatever the hell he wants, and it's not necessarily to cover something up.
No, I think you're right. And Trump, we can cycle on one of them all day long. Plenty of people do. Regardless, it really does irritate me when, particularly strident people on the left start screaming that the Russia thing, is proof that Trump was connected and that we don't know.
Right.
I believe the truth, whatever it is, is likely to come out.
Yes.
It is not looking good for some of Trump's, if I were Paul Manafort, a bunch of these guys are going to get got for money laundering.
Right.
That honestly, what Trump probably ought and probably is most afraid of is that they start digging back through, financial transactions. Because when you're talking about the kind of deals he's made, I think if you took almost anybody in the New York real estate developer world and started digging in, you'd find something you could put in a jail for.
Sure.
And
Trump makes it easier than most. I mean, you're right about that. I mean, you know, he certainly does make it easier than most when it comes to looking at that kind of stuff. You know, but it's a thing where, you know, I agree with you. I mean, the truth's going to come out on this thing. But again, I think everything has been kind of overheated on this. But a lot of that is going to come back to, again, and this is something you and I had talked about off air here, is that Trump quite frequently, as much as, you know, CNN or MSNBC might try to be, he has been his own worst enemy. I would say the majority of the time on stuff here, as you pointed out to me, you've talked to people who are Trump supporters who are not particularly patient with it. I would put my own dad in that category. He has said much the same things to me, as much as he's become kind of a cranky old Trump guy here. But yeah, I mean, there's this general sense here of picking these kind of fights that really are not suiting him in any kind of a way. And unfortunately, it requires being such a sycophant in his circle here. You've got Mike Huckabee's daughter going up there channeling an old Tommy Wildfire Rich promo from 1983 in Georgia Championship Wrestling. We're fighting fire with fire, brother! You know, these kind of things here.
Yeah.
It's well, sad know, how much it's like, going on.
You know, it is just funny as hell to hear, you know, like, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders say, basically, you know, we punch, we're going to get punched. You don't just take this lying down. You know who did take it lying down? You know who did put up with that for 8 years? Being called a traitor to America, you know, being hung in effigy. Barack Obama. So when, you know, someone like Trump is questioning his Americanness, he didn't punch back. He didn't punch back. When they go low, we go high. With Trump, when they go whatever they do, he's going to go low. And, my God, yeah, talking about, you know, I have nieces who are, you know, 12, 13 years old. And, you know, they hear this, they know this, they understand what's happening, and it horrifies them. You know, I don't think when we elect a president, we, you know, elect a role model. You know, but I think it should come along with the territory to some extent. I'm rambling a bit, but
no, I hear you.
Which no part of his personality or his character can be separated from the others. He is a package, right? And he's a 70-year-old man who, you know, hasn't changed his mind on anything he really cares about in a long time, and who feels like he succeeded at being exactly who he is. So he's not going to change. Right?
Right.
You know, the surrounding himself with sycophants, you were right on, man. Did you remember the video of that first cabinet meeting?
Right.
Where they were dripping over themselves to drip praise on him? I mean, that was something out of North Korea.
Yeah, it was, you know, to use his words that he often punctuates on Twitter with, sad to watch that.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.